From the heart of the Kootenays, this is the Friends of Kootenay Lake podcast series, Voices of the Lake.
A podcast that will help you navigate the complex function of our managed lake and how Kootenay Lake has changed and will continue to change over time. We're your hosts, Kayla Tillipaw
and Joelle Burney,
broadcasting from the traditional territories of the Tanakha, the Sinaichkst, the Shukhutmik, and Sealh First Nations.
On today's episode, we are chatting with Greg Utzig, a local conservation ecologist and land use planning consultant who has spent years exploring the wild areas of the Kootenays, performing research, modeling landscape level changes, and witnessing these changes unfold. Over the last decade, Greg has been involved with modeling and tracking the impacts of climate change to ecosystem biodiversity in the Kootenays, among other projects. More recently, he has been involved with increasing local protections for biodiversity and serving as a technical advisor for the Columbia River Treaty negotiations regarding improving the environmental conditions of Canadian reservoirs. Greg is also a board member of Friends of Kootenay Lake and helps us make important decisions around our projects and programs.
This episode is a good one and dives deep into important environmental changes occurring around Kootenay Lake, what we can continue to expect, and what we can do about it. Greg walks us through some important history to better understand historic conditions and events, what it means to build community resilience to climate change, and what steps we need to take to get there. This episode is packed full of insightful and valuable information that helps us to better understand our lake and how we can keep up with the changes that are predicted.
You're listening to River Flows, a retro soul blues ode to the beautiful Kootenay Rivers. This is such a great song, and thanks so much to Holly for sharing it with us. You can check out more of Holly's music on Instagram at Holly Hyatt and Facebook at Holly Hyatt Music. We love featuring local musicians on our podcast, and we invite you to submit your own. You can hit up our website to apply. The river flows. So hello, Greg. Thank you so much for taking the time to come on our podcast, Voices of the Lake. We're really excited to chat with you, learn about the things that you have on the go, learn about Kootenay Lake a little bit more and the hydrology, and also a bunch of changes that are happening on Kootenay Lake. And to start off, we want to get to know a little bit more about you. So you are quite an outdoor enthusiast and have spent a lot of time on Kootenay Lake and in the mountains. If you had to pick one adventure that someone should do in the Kootenays, what would it be?
Well, I'll just start out by talking about my favorite hike. And I think it's particularly relevant in these days of climate change. And that is the hike in Kokanee Glacier Park up to the Keyhole. Mm-hmm. It's a fairly strenuous hike. It's not for those faint of heart, but it's well worth it because when you come out of the Keyhole, it's just a narrow notch in the mountain and you end up right at the top of Kokanee Glacier. The views are absolutely spectacular and the setting is spectacular. You can walk out onto the glacier. Unfortunately, these days, what you'll notice mostly, particularly if you've ever been there before, is that the glacier is shrinking dramatically. Mm-hmm. Even I was shocked the last time I was up there a couple of years ago.
Oh, wow.
But in terms of the lake itself, I'd recommend kayaking on the lake. Mm-hmm. I have a small place in Johnson's Landing, and I've kayaked from Johnson's Landing down to Nelson. It was a 2.5-day trip.
Oh, wow.
I recommend something like that. It's great. It's the best way to see the lake is to be on the lake.
Yeah, definitely. I agree. Joelle and I, our first bonding experience together when Joelle first started is we went and kayaked across the lake at McDonald's Landing, and it was really windy right in the middle, and so it was super wavy. But when we got to the other side, Joelle saw her very first bald eagle, so it was like really magical.
Yeah, that was pretty sweet.
Highly recommend.
Another good kayaking experience, actually, at this time of the year, or maybe a month from now, it looks pretty hectic right now, but at this time of the year, of course, Kootenay Lake isn't controlled by the Coraline Dam. It's controlled by Groman Narrows. Mm-hmm. And so there's semi-whitewater kayaking if you put in at the transfer station down at the end of the dog walk. You can canoe down and then take out at the Tagum Beach. And it's pretty spectacular going through the Groman Narrows when the flows are as high as they are now.
I bet. That sounds really fun. Okay, well, now I want to do that. Sweet. Thanks, Greg. So yeah, tell us a little bit about yourself and the work that you do.
My background, I have degrees in geology and forest soils, but I've mainly worked as an ecologist. And at the moment, I consider myself a conservation ecologist. So looking at ways of increasing protection for biodiversity, and at the same time, the last 10 years, I've really been doing a lot of work on climate change, because of course, it's the major threat to biodiversity everywhere in the world, actually. At the moment, I'm involved with some project with Kootenai Conservation Program around climate change and biodiversity, but I'm also involved in the negotiation of the Columbia River Treaty. I'm not involved in the negotiations themselves, but as a technical advisor regarding potential impacts and changes that we can do through the negotiations to improve environmental conditions in the reservoirs in Canada. And although Kootenai Lake is, in my view, still a lake, it is certainly impacted by the Columbia River Treaty, because the inflows mainly come from water that comes out of the Duncan Dam and out of the Libby Dam in the United States. So we will be impacted by the outcome of these negotiations.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, that's a lot of really interesting and important work. And for all the listeners out there, it might be important to know also that Greg is a board member of Friends of Kootenai Lake. So he's also an advisor to our organization, and we're super lucky to have Greg on the team. Yeah, mm-hmm. He's got quite the full library of a brain, I would say. Yeah. So thanks for joining us today, Greg.
Okay, so let's chat a little bit about the changes that are happening on Kootenai Lake and just in general in our local environment. So over the last couple of years, we've witnessed some really crazy weather in the Kootenais. We've had extreme heat, extreme cold, high snowpack, low snowpack, high lake levels and low lake levels. So how much of this comes to a surprise to you, and how much has been predicted through your research of analyzing local trends?
Kootenai Lake definitely has been impacted by climate change over the last few decades. I have a small cabin in Johnson's Landing, and in 2012, due to a climate change event, it was kind of a rolling seasonal event. We had the wettest spring on record, even wetter than this spring. And then it abruptly, on July 4th that year, it changed to over 30 degree temperatures for the next couple of weeks. And of course, the snowpack at high elevation was held late like it is this year, but it abruptly melted. And it resulted in the Johnson's Landing slide, which I would consider a climate change event. It killed four of my neighbors and resulted in an incredible amount of debris put into Kootenai Lake, which, again, whenever we get high water like we have right now, that debris is liberated and creates boating hazards, but also changes everybody's beaches, potentially affects docks and things like that. So that's one major event. But in addition to that, only 1 year later in 2013, we had the storm, which did $5 billion worth of damage to Calgary. Well, that storm continued on into the north end of Kootenai Lake, and Hamel Creek, Fry Creek, and Campbell Creek all had incredible flood events, sort of 100 year or more events. Wow. Which again took out a whole bunch of riparian area and dumped a whole bunch of sediment and material into Kootenai Lake. And in each case, the fans of those creeks was completely changed where they outflow into Kootenai Lake. The high levels and low levels actually have not been dramatically affected. I know people tend to concentrate on the fact that Kootenai Lake goes up and down, but it actually goes up and down significantly less than it used to naturally. The Duncan Dam and the Libby Dam both store a significant amount of runoff at this time of the year, and that reduces the flooding in Kootenai Lake. Kootenai Lake used to go normally up to 755 or 760 feet elevation. And since the dams have been in, it's never been above 1754, something like that. And twice. Since the dams have been in, and it used to go as high as 1765.
Wow.
So
For reference, that's
people
like,
there's very few people that have been here since before the 1930s to be able to talk about what it actually used to do naturally. Right. And in terms of the lower elevations, the controlling elevation is Grohmann Narrows. It's not the dam. And therefore, the lowest elevations when it goes down to around 1739 is completely within the range it's been since deglaciation. there's not any change in the low elevation. Under natural conditions, it always went down that low and it continues to go down that low. So in terms of actual flooding or not flooding in Kootenai Lake, there really hasn't been a great effect. There probably would have been a lot more effect if the dams weren't there. The dams have attenuated that. In, you know, in 2012, where we had fairly high flooding, we went up above 1754. That would have been probably in the 1760s without the dams.
Right.
So in that sense, Kootenai Lake is somewhat protected by the dams from the impacts of climate change. Not completely, but it's certainly moderated.
Yeah. Just out of curiosity, Greg, you said that Kootenai Lake levels would get really low prior to the dams being put in, like low, as low or lower than they currently get with the dams. Is that at a different season? Because right now it's right before spring. Would that have been the same season or would that have changed?
What would have happened before the dams were put in, what the dams mainly do is hold Kootenai Lake artificially high in the fall and winter. Under natural conditions, after the spring freshet, Kootenai Lake would have dropped to that 1739, 1740 in the fall and stayed that way all the way through the winter until snowmelt began in the spring. Right. And now when snowmelt and the freshet season ends in usually in late June or July, the dam artificially keeps the lake high.
Right. Mm. Yeah. That makes sense.
So the spring low elevations are exactly as it would have been naturally or more or less.
Yeah.
What's different are the late fall and winter, which is artificially high.
Right. Yeah. I heard that Kootenai Lake used to freeze over even before the dams.
Yep. And even in, I think once since I've lived here in Nelson, I've been able to ice skate on Kootenai Lake in the bay. Only the bays froze over though.
That's so cool. I can never imagine now.
I don't think the main Kootenai Lake, I could be wrong on that, but I'm not sure the main Kootenai Lake froze over, but certainly the West Arm did freeze over. I've seen photographs.
That's so interesting. Yeah, so different. In terms of climate change and just in general, the changes that are happening in our area, what do you think are some of the most important changes that are happening that people should be aware of?
Well, I think there's two main factors, and they both kind of stem from the fact that we're getting an increased number of extremes, be they extreme precipitation events or extreme temperatures. And last year was the perfect example of the extreme temperatures. Of course, we had 40 degree temperatures. Not only are those bad for people's health, but what impacts Kootenai Lake the most is that they lead to fires, wildfires, out of control wildfires. And I would say, for the Kootenai Lake region, we've been extremely lucky over the past decade. We haven't, other than in 2003, we had some fairly significant fires. We've had some fires that you would consider significant, but compared to what's projected to be occurring, we're actually way below the curve. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the main impact we've had has been smoke from fires in other areas, but the fires in this area are bound to come, and those have an impact on Kootenai Lake. Even that there had been fires in the early 2000s in Hamel Creek. And when we had the flooding in Hamel Creek in 2013, the fact that portions of the watershed had been burned made the flooding worse and also contributed a significant amount of sediment as well as dead trees into the channel, which made the flooding even worse. So you get these interactions between wildfire and extreme precipitation events.
Totally. And can you describe where Hamel Creek is located on the lake?
Hamel Creek is the extreme north end of the lake. It's just north of Argenta.
Great, thanks. And what's the
Of Hamel Creek is in the Purcell Conservancy.
Yeah, I've heard also about like the creek that runs, I think the Castle River, was it? Or a creek that runs into the Castle River anyway near Castle, like
there have been some landslides in a tributary of the Castle River that Castle used for its water intake. Actually, it's had some severe flooding.
Yeah.
So kind of looking forward in terms of these extreme weather events, what are some of unavoidable things we are going to have to do to adapt?
Number one is we should be doing a lot of interface fire treatments, which are just beginning, but we've done, you know, maybe 10% of what we need to do to protect our communities. We need to try and reduce the fuels in our forests around the lake, particularly the lower elevation areas near communities. It's the only way that we're going to reduce the impact of crown fire, the fire that completely destroys the forests. The other thing I would say is we do need to prepare for flooding. I mean, there was a flood warning for 6 Mile Duhamel Creek area this past week. Almost all of the communities around Kootenai Lake are built on fans. Fans are where the streams run into the lake. And those areas naturally are prone to flooding and to channel movement. And what we've done is tried to restrict nature. We're going to need to either move off those fans or somehow adapt to higher flows. And an example of that would have been in 2003, there was a fire in the watershed above Kuskanook at the south end of the lake. That was a very intense fire, created hydrophobic soils, soils that repel water. The following year, just a normal thunderstorm created a landslide in the upper part of the drainage, which turned into a debris torrent that came down and took out the highway and a couple of buildings in Kuskanook. So that was that combination. We need to prepare and be ready for those kinds of events because they're certainly going to be increasing.
Yeah, well, I would love to know more about what some of those fire mitigation strategies would be. And then, well, I would love to ask you after that too about like how you see us mitigating the flooding hazards on the fans. You said something about moving, like, can we really, is that realistic? What are the other options? But I guess, yeah, first let's start with the fire mitigation. Like what are some things that are being discussed as needing to be pushed forward?
Well, it's gone beyond discussion. It's actually being implemented, but just not on the scale it needs to be. And that is reducing the fuels, taking out the forest, reducing the density of the trees, and make sure that what we leave are the largest trees and the most fire resistant ones. Mm-hmm. We're fortunate in this area that we've got Douglas fir, Western larch, and ponderosa pine, which are resistant to fire. They can take ground fires without being killed. But we've got to get the fuel around those trees removed so that the fire intensity is not enough to burn the crowns of those trees. That is being done. There's some being done above Nelson right now. It's being done in areas around Caslow and some other parts. But this is not logging in general. This is not logging as we know logging. Clear cutting is not fire mitigation. No. It's selective logging and removing the fuels at the same time.
Right, yeah. And about the fans and mitigating flooding, and with most of our communities being in these alluvial fans?
Being in the alluvial fans, well, it's a bit of a problem. I hate to recommend it because it's not what I would like to see because it's unnatural, but, you know, diking or creating berms, making sure that houses are resilient to flooding. I mean, in the case of, we do have some diking that has been done. For example, in Hamel Creek, the problem there was Duhamel Creek was the potential that a dike could fail because it was a dike that was built many, many decades ago and it's not been maintained. Those kind of structures need to be maintained and in good condition. In terms of saying moving off, retreat is mainly talked about in relation to climate change along the coast because sea level is rising and you're not going to beat back the ocean. In the case of streams and fans, people have built in areas which are naturally hazardous. And we should think about zoning requirements that stop that kind of development. In terms of moving people off, well, in some strategic areas where there's a really high risk, it may mean protecting those structures or suggesting removing those structures. Right. Because otherwise, we're just going to continually pay to replace them.
Right. Yeah. Do you feel like we're sort of on track with a lot of this, or do you feel like we're totally like not meeting our requirements as of yet?
I would say totally not meeting. There's discussions at best in most cases. Right. I mean, it's typical in terms of Kootenai Lake itself. We have a problem with accretions where people add on to their lots into the floodplain of the lake. Right. And the surveyor general has said, yeah, go for it, when reality says the lake actually is higher now than it was 10 years ago. And people are building in places they shouldn't be building. We need tighter zoning regulations in terms of staying back from the high water level in the lake. But it's not just a matter of distance. It's a matter of elevation is probably much more significant.
Right. Totally. Yeah, that's huge. Yeah, whenever I've thought about the issue of accretions, I've always just thought, oh, you know, people are trying to take more land, but it is a safety hazard. Mm. Yeah, that's important.
Yeah. So let's talk a little bit about resilience. So many experts and knowledge keepers talk about building a resilient community or ecosystem to essentially adapt to climate change. But what does this really mean?
Well, resilience is basically the opposite of vulnerability. It's reducing vulnerability to extreme events. And, you know, in terms of around Kootenai Lake, I mean, flooding is obviously one of the issues. And building resilience to flooding is getting out of the flood zone would be ideal, which is what we've been just discussing in terms of potentially moving or zoning people off the floodplains. But the other part of resilience is to build in some kind of defensive mechanism, like having your house built to a higher elevation, not having your furnace and important equipment in a crawl space that might flood. Those kinds of things are building resilience. I would also say that resilience can, in terms of Kootenai Lake, comes from protecting the watersheds that flow into Kootenai Lake. Right. Changing the way in which we log would be a major change in terms of building resilience against these flood events. Mm-hmm. If you look at the major event we had last fall at the coast with the atmospheric mm-hmm. river and the extreme mm-hmm. flooding, when you look at where the four people died, they didn't die. It's said to be climate change and that extreme event killed those people that were swept off the highway. But that particular landslide that swept them off the highway originated from a poorly built logging road. So mm-hmm. resilience is not creating those kinds of situations. Mm-hmm. The flooding in Grand Forks 5 years ago, which flooded even the downtown of Grand Forks, was an extreme climate event, but at the same time, there is extensive clear cutting in the watersheds mm-hmm. that lead into Grand Forks. And right. those definitely contributed to the high runoff from snowfall or snowmelt. So mm-hmm. therefore, it's changing our actions to build resilience. It's not just creating defenses, but also preventing the impacts of climate change right. from multiplying other issues.
Totally. I recall even like there was a landslide like 3 years ago between Casagar and Nelson. And I think that one yep. was linked to a poorly built Forest Service road as well, wasn't it?
That's correct.
Yeah. Yeah.
So just another question to add on to that too. I was doing a bit of, you know, research and saw that there's like the Kootenai Resilience website. And I know you've contributed a little bit of work to that as well. But are there any plans that the like municipality has in place to eventually work towards a resilient community here?
The city of Nelson has taken on climate change. They have had various committees. They've hired consultants to look at building resilience in the community. And I think they're doing a fair bit of things. But again, it's, you know, there's adaptation and there's, quote, deep adaptation. Deep adaptation, whereas you place at the top of every agenda, every decision that you make should take into account climate change. The first question you should ask for any thing you do is, number one, is this going to make me more resilient or less resilient to climate change? And is it going to reduce my carbon output or is it going to increase my carbon output? Mm-hmm. And if you can answer positively to both of those questions, then you should proceed. If you can't, you should change what you're doing. Adaptation will only go so far. What's most important is stopping emitting carbon. We will not adapt to a 4-degree world. And right now we're headed for at least a 3-degree world unless we change what we're doing dramatically. Mm-hmm. Adaptation only goes so far.
Right.
Yeah.
My emphasis would be on reducing emissions before I would be emphasizing adaptation, although we need to do both. Mm-hmm. And ideally, the actions we do to adapt are done in such a way that they contribute to mitigation as well. In other words, we do them not only to protect ourselves, but also at the same time, try to reduce our carbon footprint.
Yeah. You make it sound so simple, Greg. I would love to know if you have an example of a community that you think is doing it right.
No, I don't have one.
No? Oh, man. Come on, Greg. Don't get my hopes down like that. Okay. Well, who's doing it the best so far that you've heard about or witnessed?
It's not like compared to what we need to be doing, no one is doing enough.
Yeah.
Canada is per capita, one of the highest emitters in the world. We're in a class with the United States, Saudi Arabia, and the UAE. we're not doing it right. We're building pipelines. We're promoting the tar sands. We're building infrastructure for fracked natural gas. We're making the problem worse. We're not making it better.
Right.
Yeah. Well, in terms of what you think can be done in our communities to build resilience, you talked a bit about what you think we need to do to adapt. And obviously, stopping carbon outputs is one way of mitigating. But are there any other sort of mitigative or maybe other methods of adaptation that you push for in our local communities or that you advocate for or that others do?
I'm not able to name a community that I think is doing a great job. I can certainly point to particular projects that the city of Nelson is taking on that have positive aspects to them. Certainly promoting non-carbon emitting modes of transportation, like talking about battery powered buses, talking about transportation corridors for bicycles and for walking and improving access to that. But unfortunately, what I've seen is that they often tend to compromise for cars. People right. still like their cars. They don't want to give up their cars. Yeah. I mean, the kind of, you know, basic thing City of Nelson could do is offer free parking for fully electric vehicles. They don't do that. They did put in a bicycle lane across the city, and there was a proposal to actually have a fully protected bicycle lane. Mm-hmm. They opted not to do that. It's a shared lane with cars, and it has a bunch of speed bumps in it, which makes it very uncomfortable to ride. Mm-hmm. Let's go all the way.
Yeah.
Let's do it 100%. And
yeah.
I think that, you know, promoting higher density, which, although I don't like to see all these tall boxes being built, aesthetically, on the other hand, you know, it reduces people's need for commuting. So there are positive things that are happening. They're just not happening fast enough or not enough of them.
Yeah. Yeah. Nelson's such a bikeable community, and people already, there's so many bicyclists, cyclists and walkers in Nelson. Like, it just seems so accommodating to just do it. Just go for it.
Nelson, I live in the top of uphill in Nelson. And I mean, the biggest, obviously, factor is the hill.
Yeah.
I would like to see them identify a route that makes it reasonable to go from downtown to uptown or vice versa.
Yeah.
But with the introduction of electric bicycles, it's made a huge difference. People can make it up the hill. Even us older people can make it up the hill with an electric bicycle.
Mm-hmm.
So, but, you know, we don't have any bicycle lanes or bicycle travel corridors that go up and down the hill. They just go across the bottom. Well, that doesn't do any of us for live on uphill.
Right. Totally. So we got a bit of time left, so I'm going to throw in another question. So of all the changes that we can expect on Kootenai Lake, a lot of the big changes that maybe we can see happen relate to the changes that are happening with the Columbia River Treaty, and Greg, you are very involved with that. I was wondering if you could, we don't have time obviously to get super into it, but could you sort of describe some of the work that you're doing and how you see this work impacting the future of the lake?
Well, one aspect that actually directly affects the lake is, in terms of the projects I'm involved in, I'm working with the three First Nations, the Tanaha, the Squamek, and the Okanagan Silks, and they're mainly looking through changes in the treaty to make environmental gains, including bringing back salmon, but also other things like trying to revegetate fringes around the reservoirs. And that's the part that I'm most involved in, is figuring out ways that we can manage the reservoirs in such a way that we can revegetate the upper elevations within the reservoir footprints. But one aspect is also the two treaty dams do impact Kootenai Lake, the Libby Dam and the Duncan Dam. And there are extensive wetlands that still occur at the north end of Kootenai Lake and the south end of Kootenai Lake. So one of the things that we're looking at is ways in which to regulate those reservoirs that flow into Kootenai Lake such that we can maintain those wetlands in a fully functioning condition. And in contrast to people who have places around the lake who don't like flooding at all, those wetlands need flooding. So it's trying to come up with a balanced way of managing the levels in Kootenai Lake such that we do maintain the wetlands, but also minimize flooding to people's structures. That's one direct one. Right. The other thing is the way in which the flows will affect the fisheries in Kootenai Lake, obviously.
Mm. Please elaborate. How will the flows affect the fisheries?
Well, the biggest problem with the dams is the fact that they block all the nutrients that at one time came into Kootenai Lake. The other is they block movement of fish. But the one example I'll pull out is actually a U.S. example. But of course, the Kootenai River begins in the East Kootenays, flows down into the Libby Reservoir through the Libby Dam, and then through the Kootenai River and comes back into Kootenai Lake and Creston. Sturgeon was a prime fisheries for the First Nations at the south end of Kootenai Lake. Sturgeon have not reproduced in the Kootenai River since the Libby Dam went in. And so we have a cohort of very old sturgeon and a lot of young sturgeon that we've reintroduced from hatcheries. We're trying to figure out ways to manipulate the Libby flows such that it will stimulate and allow sturgeon to start reproducing in the Kootenai River. It's mainly projects within the United States, but that's a good example of the way the flows affect fisheries in Kootenai Lake.
Right.
I would really recommend that people living around Kootenai Lake make an effort to explore how Kootenai Lake actually operates, what makes it go up and down, what controls Kootenai Lake, mm-hmm. where do the waters in Kootenai Lake come from and how are they controlled, so that you understand and expect the changes that happen seasonally when Kootenai Lake, it's a very defined system. Not every year is the same, for sure, basically depending on the weather in that given year. But I find that people tend to just look at the lake and expect a lake to stay the same level all the time. And it has never done that, never will do that. And if you want to enjoy Kootenai Lake, it's best to understand how it works and what to expect.
That's right. And is there any like specific resources that people can be directed to learn that information? Or is there any spot where it's all laid out where they can easily
Well, I think we should try and get that paper I wrote published. And then we can provide that resource.
Oh,
it's probably the most fulsome resource at the moment.
Yeah, hint, hint, sneak peek, everyone stay tuned.
I hate to say that, but in terms of other sources, I mean, it's kind of disparate. There's the International Joint Commission and the Board of Control for Kootenai Lake, but they don't kind of have a summary of everything. Yeah. And an historical kind of context in how Kootenai Lake has run and what has happened to Kootenai Lake over the decades. And like I say, things have been changing mm-hmm. even over the last few years.
Yeah. Well, to all the listeners out there, if you are curious and you're not the type of person who is able to just read website page after website page, we're going to talk to Greg again one of these days about this history and about the levels, because Greg's got a lot of that knowledge, and we're going to have another podcast one of these days, so something to look forward to. Thanks so much, Greg.
Great. Thanks a lot for you guys for doing these series. It's been really good, so it's good.
Thanks for tuning in to Voices of the Lake. Stay updated on what we've been up to. Follow us on Facebook and Instagram at Friends of Kootenai Lake. Read our blog post at friendsofkootenailake.ca and sign up to our monthly e-newsletter.
Huge thanks to our funders, Fortis BC and the Regional District of Central Kootenai, for helping us to bring these stories to you.
Again, you're listening to River Flows by Holly Hyatt. Be sure to check out her music on Facebook and Instagram. Thanks so much, Holly Hyatt.
Oh, and I hear her.